The trouble with going on holiday is that it's always so stressful. For us, they always start on the wrong note when we're packing and getting ready to leave. Because however hard we plan, however rigorously we make lists and try and get things ready in advance, it always, without exception, descends into a last-minute frenzy of shouting and running around and up and down the stairs, of waiting for the tumble dryer to finish or the toilet to be free, emptying and then repacking the suitcase with a crowbar this time to get things in, changing last-minute nappies, rushing out to buy a bigger suitcase or roof rack or car, setting off down the road, then coming back for all the things that you've forgotten. And you leave the house in such a state of chaos that I, for one, would prefer to buy a new one and start again than have to come back and sort that one out. We as a family are not set up for a mobile lifestyle, neither practically nor in our attitudes. People who are used to living on the move handle it all really rather better. For many years, my sister lived in a small caravan as part of a travelling fair. And in the travelling season, 2, 3, maybe 4 times a week, they would have to pack up all of their stalls and their homes and relocate somewhere else in the county. But the caravan was always immaculately tidy. Everything had its own assigned place, neatly stowed away. There was no unnecessary junk to be seen anywhere. And every move was a slick, efficient process. It was ironic because, as a girl, her room was an absolute tip. It was like a tornado in an Oxfam shop. But the requirements of living on a move had changed her practice and her attitudes. Because living on the move requires a certain discipline, a certain focus. You've got to work to keep it together. You just can't afford to let things slip. And we've been thinking in our morning services about how we in the church are spiritual pilgrims. Although we may well live in the same place all of our lives, we're to think of ourselves as people on the move, people heading for heaven, who don't really belong where we are. And our model is this community of Israelites, travelling through the desert from slavery in Egypt to the promised land, and their story is recounted in Numbers. And today we're thinking about those disciplines we need to be a successful pilgrim people. And so we're going to take an overview of chapters 1 to 10. What I'm going to say is very much an attempt to summarise some of the themes. So don't worry, I'm not intending to read all of those chapters to you. The text we're going to look at together is not apparently the most interesting text in the Bible, but it lets us see three important themes that emerge from these opening chapters as Israel get ready to go. And those three themes are unity, sanctity, and destiny. We'll see what those mean in a moment. We're going to read from Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. The people of Israel are at Sinai, the place where God first made his covenant with them and gave the Ten Commandments. 10, verse 11 says, "On the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle of the testimony. Then the Israelites set out from the desert of Sinai and traveled from place to place, until the cloud came to rest in the desert of Paran. They set out, this first time, at the Lord's command through Moses. The divisions of the camp of Judah went first, under their standard. Nashon, son of Amminadab, was in command. Nethanel, son of Zuar, was over the division of the tribe of Issachar. And Eliab, son of Helon, was over the division of the tribe of Zebulun. Then the tabernacle was taken down, and the Gershonites and Merarites who carried it set out." Now the next three paragraphs are in a similar vein, and I'm not going to read them all to you because they're an absolute tongue twister. But we find that all the different tribes of Israel were assigned their place in the marching order. And it concludes verse 28. "This was the order of march for the Israelite divisions as they set out. Now Moses said to Hobab, son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, 'We are setting out for the place about which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will treat you well, for the Lord has promised good things to Israel." He answered, "No, I'll not go. I'm going back to my own land and my own people." But Moses said, "Please do not leave us. You know where we should camp in the desert, and you can be our eyes. If you come with us, we will share with you whatever good things the Lord gives us." So they set out from the mountain of the Lord and traveled for 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them during those 3 days to find them a place to rest. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. Whenever the ark set out, Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, may your enemies be scattered, may your foes flee before you." Whenever it came to rest, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel." Our first theme is unity. The message is, on the move, maintain your unity. You'll see that in this passage, the people set out in good order. Each of the 12 tribes had their place in the great procession. So that's what those verses from 14 to 28 tell us about. Verse 28, "This was the order of march for the Israelite divisions as they set out." 12 tribes each had their slot in the marching order. God instructed the people to always march along in this particular pattern. And we have the names given of the respective leaders, the tongue twisters like Shalumiel, son of Zurishaddai, and others too. Now if you flick back in the book of Numbers to chapters 1 and 2, the very beginning of the book, you'll see that there's a lot more attention to detail there, which we won't read now. But you'll see that there are lots of lists of names of people from the different tribes, and the men of the tribes, at least, the fighting men, have all been counted and recorded, the numbers in each different tribe. That's why the title for this book is the Book of Numbers. You see, in the Greek version of it, it's the word for numbers that gives it its title, although perhaps that's not the best title for it. You think about what you think the best title might be in your own time. Now, this raises a question. Why bother recording all these carefully laid out instructions and records? After all, it sort of puts you off reading the rest of the book, doesn't it, if you have to struggle through all these difficult and boring names and numbers. At the time, you could see that it mattered. The instructions and records were a logistical necessity. You couldn't move such a vast number of people without them, without there being chaos. But why bother recording them for posterity when there are so many other important things to be said and read? What use is it to us? Well, it teaches us important principles about how God's people, that's us, are to now move together as one. Everyone has their place, we learn. Everyone has their place. I don't know what you do when you see an ant's nest in your garden. Ignore it? Pour boiling water on it? Collect a jar full of blacks to mix in with the reds and start a war, perhaps? Next time, just stop and watch for a while. Marvel at how they work with such common purpose and vision, with no managers or administrators, or even central nervous systems to guide them and tell them what to do. Amazing creation, isn't it? What those little ants can achieve. And then try to count them. You can't do that, can you? And that's not just because there are so many of them, but also because they are all the same. You'd never know if you'd counted one once, twice, or 10 times, would you? Ants, you see, are interchangeable. The individuals don't matter in that great machine. If one ant gets lost or squashed or taken out by the reds, all the others don't notice. They just keep on marching. The function of the machine is unaffected by the destiny of the individual. Ants are strong on efficiency, but weak on personality. Now, we too are in some ways like an ant because we are all part of a whole called to march and work together. But unlike the ants, we are individuals. We are counted and named and recorded. That, of course, is the ultimate truth in heaven. In God's books, he knows everyone who belongs to him. There's no doubts in his mind about that. But it's also a truth that we should set out to express in the church on earth as well. It's not enough to leave it as a spiritual principle, if you like. We need to know where we belong, where we have our place. We need to know where we would be missed if we got squashed or taken out by the Reds. Everyone does their bit, we learn. We see that, for instance, in the case of the Levites in this section we read, verse 17. Then the tabernacle was taken down, and the Gershonites and the Merarites who carried it set out. Then in verse 21 we find, then the Kohathites set out, carrying the holy things. The tabernacle was to be set up before they arrived. Then back in chapter 4 we find how the different clans of priests and Levites had their own particular duties for the tabernacle. The Kohathites, the Gershonites, the Merarites, each different families within that special tribe, had their own sections of the tabernacle and all its fittings to carry. And so you presume that if one lot didn't show, the whole lot didn't go, because nobody else could collect all the tabernacle furniture together and move it, except the Kohathites, and so on. They weren't interchangeable. They all had their particular role. More broadly, if you flick on to chapter 7, you find another chapter which you wouldn't normally think of reading right the way through because it's very repetitive. We find how all the different tribes of Israel each made their offering, all 12 of them, one day after the other, as contribution to the furnishings that would go inside this special tabernacle. So 12 times the same formula is repeated, and you'll see if you just pick one example that they all brought plates and sprinkling bowls and sacrifices and so on. So everybody contributed to the whole. And whenever it was time to go, whenever it was time to move, all the tribes had to be ready and waiting to go. So if, say, the tribe of Dan couldn't get up in the morning in time, they always had trouble with the tribe of Dan, I'm afraid, nobody else could leave. You were just standing there. The gap was obvious. And so in the New Testament church, as Paul puts it, in Christ, we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to all of the others. One Spirit gives each one of us different gifts for the common good. We all belong, but we also have our responsibility. And setting things up this way, God gives us both the dignity of knowing that we have a place and a responsibility to fulfill, yet he also places a requirement upon it, because everyone else depends upon us to be doing our part. But the community of Israel was large and diverse, hundreds of thousands of people. How could this crowd move together in practice? Ants do it by instinct. It's programmed into their genes. They're responding to chemical signals that come from each other and their environment. We human beings are not like that. Having brains and personalities has its drawback, you see. We can't just rely on genes and chemicals and instincts to work together. We need something to bring us together and unite us. And the people of Israel were united because everyone had one vision. Everyone had one vision, one thing to guide them and focus them. Verse 11 of chapter 10. On the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle of the testimony. And there in verse 34, the cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. And it's by this cloud by day and fire by night that God himself led and directed the movements of the Israelites. You'll see a longer section about that back there in chapter 9, verses 15 to 23. So 9 verse 17 says, Whenever the cloud lifted from above the tent, the Israelites set out. Whenever the cloud settled, the Israelites encamped. So they had one focus, one thing to steer them and guide them. Now, a New Testament church on a spiritual pilgrimage will look very different. But the same principles need to be in place if we're to get anywhere. Every one of us who is serious about our faith, that is, every one of us who counts ourselves a Christian, should belong properly to the local expression of the church. Whether that's Surrey Chapel, if you're a regular here, or to whatever church you would normally go to if you're just visiting us today. There should be a place where you will be missed if you aren't there. A place where you belong. Sometimes circumstances arise when we can't honestly say we've got that right now. Say you've just moved house. Still settling in, of course. Or say you've been through one of those bruising and battering experiences that happen to many of us in our church lives from time to time. And we need to find a place to resettle, perhaps. Well, of course, those things happen. But if you're a Christian, you should never settle for it to be normal, to not have your own place in God's local church. You need to belong somewhere as soon as you can. Here, I hope. But I can honestly say that I would far rather that you belonged and contributed properly to another good church somewhere else than simply sort of dipped in to Surrey Chapel from time to time. It's much better for you, much better for the kingdom of God, and be much better for us in the end, I think, if every Christian knows the place where they belong and is really stuck in there than if they just dipped in to different places. What does that mean? Well, belonging properly, in my view, does mean actually being a member of the church which you take part in. Now, I know that a lot of us have strong instincts against that. We hate the idea of signing up for things and so on. And, of course, the systems where we run our membership and so on are never perfect. The Bible doesn't say do it this way or that way and so on. But nonetheless, I think there has to be a way for us to say, I belong here, I'm committed here. And I want the church to keep an eye on me. I think that it's the culture of our age speaking when we resist ever signing up for anything or committing to an institution. I would also say that belonging properly means more than just coming to a church on a Sunday. Now, of course, coming to a church on a Sunday is very important, probably the most important thing that we do together. But there are things that we can't do. There are things that we can't be all together on a Sunday. Our Sunday services are public occasions. Anybody and everybody is invited and welcome. We're catering for guests and for visitors, a whole spectrum of people. So we can't do the things which perhaps need to be done in a more private environment as a church. A Sunday service is normally too big to feel like you really belong and can get to know very many people. There are many things that we simply can't do just by being together on a Sunday. But equally, I know that we can easily, all too easily, get overloaded with church meetings if we're not careful. And the last thing we want is for Christians to just live in a holy huddle and never have anything to do with the rest of the world. Of course not. We want people to be out there engaged with things that are going on. As a rough guideline, I reckon on the principle that if you come to one midweek thing on a regular basis, I call that a reasonable commitment for the average person. Some who can do more, of course. Some may not be able to do that much. But I reckon on doing one thing regularly each week outside a Sunday service will let you belong properly and contribute. Once a week, for instance, if you came regularly, you could take in a month a church night, a fellowship group, and at least one other prayer meeting. Then if you add to that one area of service in the life of the church, not only will you belong yourself, you'll also be contributing to the life of the church and will be in a position to move forward together. The Bible doesn't give us a program, you see. We have to work out our own program. But the Bible gives us a principle. In the Old Testament, the ancient Israelites, you were expected to participate in the Passover, for instance. That was one example of the things which held people together. Numbers chapter 9, the first section of it, tells us about the role of Passover among the people traveling through the desert. The Lord spoke to Moses in the desert of Sinai in the first month of the second year after they came out of Egypt. He said, "Make the Israelites celebrate the Passover at the appointed time. Celebrate it at the appointed time at twilight on the 14th day of this month, in accordance with all its rules and regulations." And under the Old Testament law, you had to do it. There was no excuse, there was no option about celebrating the Passover. But what about if you really couldn't? You were on a journey. You were ceremonially unclean because somebody close to you had died or something like that. Well, that wasn't a problem. You could just take the Passover the next month. Because God is not stupid. God is not unreasonable. God knows the constraints that we live our lives under. Be encouraged, those of us who really do have good reasons why involvement is hard and is sometimes irregular for us. But to just opt out for no good reason was a serious matter for the people of Israel. Verse 13. If a man who is ceremonially clean and not on a journey fails to celebrate the Passover, that is, somebody doesn't do it just because they can't be bothered or doesn't get it together, that person must be cut off from his people. That is, exiled. Because he did not present the Lord's offering at the appointed time. That man will bear the consequences of his sin. He's showing that he doesn't really care about God. Now, the New Testament doesn't say, you must do this, you must do that. You, as a mature individual, have to work out the particular shape of your involvement. But don't be taken in by the culture of our age, which likes tasting things, but never commits to anything. If our church is to move ahead, and if you're to move ahead, then we all need to be in our right places. We have to take a disciplined approach to being God's people on the move. And it's so much more of a blessing for you in that too, if you take up your place. In a real church, you see, you will never find customer satisfaction. Customer satisfaction does not exist in churches. You will only ever find contributor satisfaction. Contributor satisfaction. If people just opt in and out according to whim, they never flourish spiritually. So looking ahead to this year, and those of us who come here regularly, let me remind you again of Church Night, this particular initiative that we've taken. Because in many ways, I would see them as fulfilling a role rather like that pillar of fire for the Israelites, giving us a common focus as we seek to move ahead together. Get those first Tuesday evenings into your diary if you can. The idea of God being with his people leads us on to our second discipline for a people on the move, which is preserve your sanctity. That is, being sacred and pure. That mattered for Israel because God himself was in the camp. Verse 33, so they set out from the mountains of the Lord and travelled for 3 days. The ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them during those 3 days to find them a place to rest. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. Something else we can learn from the ants is that they know what really matters. At the heart of their nest is the queen. Now, she doesn't do much except lay eggs, although I'm sure that is no tea party. But she is the source of life for the colony. She makes them who they are. At all costs, the queen must be protected and preserved. If there is a flood or the reds attack, well, as long as the queen survives, the colony survives. She gives them their identity. At the heart of the community of God's people is the presence, not of a queen, but of God himself. He makes us who we are. He's the one who guides his people to their destination. He's the one who defeats the enemies along the way. Verse 35. Whenever the ark set out, Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, may your enemies be scattered and your foes flee before you." He is the one who finds the places of rest, verse 36. Whenever it came to rest, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel." And aren't those two things that we all need along our journey? We want victory. We want action. We want progress. The church moving forward, making an impact, reaching out and helping other people. And we want peace, refuge, refreshment. We need to be able to enjoy being the people of God, to give us strength for the way ahead. Victory and peace, action and rest, apparently contradictory things, but they come to us from the presence of a holy God. And God is only present among a holy people. Now, the relationship between sinful people and a holy God is a tough one. It's one of those can't live with him, can't live without him sort of situations. On one hand, God is the source of life and everything. On the other hand, God is dangerous. Sinful people and a holy God go together, naturally speaking, like snowmen and the Sahara. His holiness, if you like, is awesome and consuming. And much of the early chapters of Numbers and all of this section of the Bible, Exodus and Leviticus, is about how the people could live with a holy God amongst them. The law provided a special place, the tabernacle, this tent where God's presence was located. They were given special people, priests and Levites, to do the dangerous business of dealing with God. And we see that in chapters 3 and 4. Then there were lots of special regulations as to how people could keep themselves clean. Chapters 5 and 6, there were some examples. Those regulations, of course, if you've ever read the Old Testament law, can seem very strange to the likes of us. Of course, they were ceremonial ones, not the real thing. God doesn't actually mind whether people wear linen underpants, for instance. But the priests had to. The whole system instilled a sense of holiness and sanctity, of specialness, that was crucial to the nation's existence. Now, the old system was a temporary schoolmaster, who is now redundant. But the principle he taught remains. And if you think the old system that Israel lived under was daft and silly, just ask yourself, what have we got now? What have we got now? Where nowadays do we find a sense of holiness, of sacredness and awesomeness? The answer is hardly anywhere. Everything is cynical and dirty and smutty. Anything goes, sneer, snigger and spit where you like. It's the spiritual equivalent of chain smoking in a maternity ward, or playing heavy metal music in a cathedral, or lighting a bonfire of old tyres in a forest glade. It's offensive, yet we hardly notice, because the whole idea of sacredness is just fading away from our collective consciousness. And it affects us in churches because we absorb the atmosphere around us without even realising. Without thinking, we can become casual and careless about God. And the danger is, we may find the presence of God is then far from us, and we have neither victory nor peace. But how do we maintain a sense of sanctity? In the New Testament, it's not about an external religious setup that controls our attitude. It's about an internal attitude that controls our actions. Because of Jesus, we may be confident in approaching God, but we must never be complacent about our sins. We may be intimate and natural in how we relate to him, but never irreverent or casual in our attitude to him. When we talk to each other about human situations, we feel free to laugh and joke, even, dare I say it, in a sermon, if that gets the message across. But woe betide us if we ever started inserting witty one-liners in our prayers to God, or started talking about him as if he was a topic for humour. Don't let the scornful, trivialising world infect our thinking about God and what he has said is holy. Being holy, you see, is not just about being moral. It's not just about avoiding naughty things. There are plenty of outward, correct, moral people who are thoroughly obnoxious to God. And quite a lot of those people go to church. True holiness is about having the right attitude of respect to God. And from that, respect for God's right and wrongs naturally flows. And it's got to come from the heart. You can't manufacture reverence for God by imposing external rules, Old Testament style. There are churches who have lost the presence of God by following the world's agenda, you see. They've had the best motives. They want to engage with the culture of the world, and so they've pushed the boat out, looking for action and success. But they've lost the plot. And maybe they've ended up denying the truth or trivializing him. But there's an opposite problem in churches as well. Again, with the best possible motives, try to preserve reverence for an awesome God, people have put on an overly stern and conservative, serious sort of manner. They've pulled up the cultural drawbridge, seeking to be secure and safe. But of course, God is no more impressed by self-satisfied people putting on a show of formality than he is by self-absorbed people being chummy with him. There's nothing intrinsically sacred about the culture of a past age. And that brings us to our third and briefer discipline for pilgrims. Maintain our unity, preserve our sanctity, and remember our destiny. And that comes through in what Moses said to this chap Hobab. He wanted to be their guide. We are setting out for the place about which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us and we will treat you well, for the Lord has promised good things to Israel. And that's what it's all about, you see. There's a number of dangers on the road for pilgrims. One danger is quitting, going back to Egypt, giving up on being a Christian. But another danger is this. On the way through the desert to the promised land, God leads us to an oasis, a present, pleasant stopping place where we can refresh and refuel. So we hammer our tent pegs in deep, go for a swim, catch some rays, and hope that we're going to stay there for a while. And then when the cloud looks likely to move, we see the dust storms and the sand dunes ahead, and we think, no, actually, it's quite nice here. I think we'll stay where we are for now. God brought us here after all. And it's a lot more secure than that dangerous journey ahead. And we forget that our destiny is in heaven. And in this life, we must always move and travel. We give up on being pilgrims and become settlers. Many of us have been to a church, perhaps on holiday or in some new town, and thought, wow, a real life time warp. Doctor Who would love this. I've gone back a whole century at least. The music, the clothes, the way people talk, the issues that concern them, the comfort of the seating. It must take real effort and commitment to eliminate the modern world so thoroughly and completely from everything they're saying and doing. It's like one of those interactive museums where out-of-work actors spend their summer holidays pretending to be, you know, Iron Age peasants or Victorian shopkeepers or something like that. Yet this is for real. And once upon a time, of course, God was busy and at work. Someone can normally point you to a plaque on the wall and say, oh yes, when I was a girl, so-and-so was here as the minister or whatever, and in the 1940s the church was absolutely thriving. And you look around and think, where did things go wrong? Did they sell out the gospel, the glory of God, to the sinful world? Probably not. And quite possibly exactly the opposite. The Lord moved on, the pillar of fire and smoke headed for the horizon. But they didn't. They, without really thinking about it, sought to live on in the oasis of God's blessing, provided for a past age, but which now has dried up. They hung on to the eternal truths of our God well enough, but they also hung on to the temporary culture of the past, which now has had its day. An essential discipline of pilgrim people is to always be asking, what are we doing here? Why are we doing these things? Is it because Scripture tells us for all time to do these things in these ways? Or is it simply because God has blessed us this way in the past and we haven't really thought about whether we should change things? If so, could He be calling us to move on now? We always have to be willing to consider changing not the truths we believe about the God we love, but the way in which we express them. And it takes courage to do that. As I said before, we take the risk of making mistakes, and we have to trust ourselves to the grace of God. But we cannot afford to treat any temporary oasis like its home. If we read the Bible for what it's worth, in fact, we will find that the unchanging Word of God actually is the thing that prompts us to change ourselves. And that's what I hope we will find happening in our church over the years ahead. So a final reminder of the three disciplines to equip us to live faithfully as pilgrims this year. Pilgrim people must contribute and always be willing to take up their place, to do their bit, to share one vision. Pilgrim people must preserve their sanctity and always be careful to respect the presence of God amongst them. Pilgrim people must remember their destiny and always be willing to move and to change when God calls us to do so.